The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
It's time for the John DePietro Show here on News Talk, WNRI, 1380 AM and 99.9 and 95.1 FM.
He's a special kind of sentinel.
Mr. DePietro, who is in the eye of the storm.
Suddenly, John DePietro became the story.
Radio talk show host, John DePietro.
All right, here we go. Hey, good afternoon, one and all. Here I am. It's Juan. It's John DePietro. Weekdays, we start at 11. We go till 2. It's AM 1380, 99.9 FM. You can always listen online at DePietro.com or WNRI.com and Facebook Live. This portion of our program is brought to you by Immortal Seats. Call them today, 888-933-SEAT. Immortal Seats. You can also download their free app, the best place for tickets. You can also sell your ticket through Immortal Seats. Call them 888-933-SEAT. They have an office right in North Providence, but the best thing to do is download their free app. It's immortalseats.com. Hey, this season, how about you can also tickets, maybe you know what, make a great gift, tickets to the Celtics or the Bruins or the Patriots. They also have tickets for Taylor Swift and Kenny Chesney. What I love about Immortal Seats is when you click on, let's just say for a nice gift, and this makes a great gift, you want to get someone tickets to a Celtics game. Well, when you click on Immortal Seats, go to their website, immortalseats.com. You click on, you can see exactly what the view would be like from those seats. Now, there's also, there's no fee in the price you see. That's it. No fees. Immortal Seats. How about you want to take someone to a Patriots game or a Bruins game or a Celtics game? You know what would make a great Christmas gift? How about Taylor Swift tickets, Kenny Chesney, both coming to Gillette? Or go on the road game for your favorite team. The best thing to do is download their free app, immortalseats.com. I like it. They say memories one ticket at a time. Immortal Seats, you can also look for their Facebook page. And they also, again, they have an office in North Providence on Smith Street. No fees. The price you see, that's it. You can see the view from the ticket. And when you download the app, your first purchase with the app is 30% off. How about that? Bruins tickets. For that's a nice Christmas gift. Immortal Seats. Go online, immortalseats.com. But the best thing to do is download their free app. I love the fact Michael was showing it to me. You could see exactly, okay, you want to get tickets for the Celtics. You press on it. That would be your view from the Celtics game or wherever it may be. Immortal Seats. Download the free app, immortalseats.com. Let's bring him on for our political segment. He's the managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. We want to say good afternoon to Justin Katz. Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, John. Great to join you.
Hey, Justin, I want to start off with what happened, this whole situation with Women's Caucus breaking off from the Democrat Party. I think this is another indication that the party, certainly to me, seems to have a lot of division within it, almost like a civil war. And then it even extended beyond that to this former state senator, big lobbyist, though, when he's on the state Democratic committee, Stephen Alves, is calling on the number of the women, the members of the Women Caucus, pigs. But a big display and breaking off and screaming that their rights are being violated. I'd first like to hear your thoughts on this Women's Caucus breaking off and basically forming their own division within the Democrat Party.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the turkeys coming home to roost, so to speak, for the Democrats and the left. More generally, I mean, this kind of protest, identity politics of it all, the sense that, you know, you don't have to, you have a right to protest and be heard and to force a change to rules outside of the system. While that's needed in the insider establishment of Rhode Island, while we need that, I think the Democrats in Rhode Island thought they were creating a movement that was going to disrupt the other side and not their own side. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is that sort of thing, and where as the progressives gain influence in the party, they're not they've been told that they're everybody's on the same side, that the Democrat Party agrees with them, all of this stuff, that climate justice, identity politics, all of it. And yet when you get closer to the handles of government and there's got to be some restraint and some give and take, then they've been told this story of their righteousness for so long that they're not willing to listen to that, and they want a stronger seat at the table. And to some extent, I mean, that's where a lot of the energy is, so they have a claim to a stronger seat, and the insiders are pushing back on it. So I think that's the dynamic we're seeing, and it's going to be very disruptive for the insiders, especially if they take too long getting used to the fact that they're going to be goaded and they're going to be filmed when they respond to somebody inside a closed-door meeting, and could get these kind of uncomfortable headlines for the next week or two.
I think you're right. And also, it seems to me, Justin, we've kind of talked about this, is to me this is like another example of people that they don't want to fit into the structure. They're almost like anti-structure because in defense of the Democrat Party, you have these people that just decide, okay, we're just the Women's Caucus. And so they're sending out press releases using the logo and the letterhead of the Democrat Party. They want to just fundraise on their own. And it's all under the guise with no one, and I get it why it's because of the Democrat Party, but someone who you would think would be the most prominent member, two prominent members to me are missing from this, quote, Women's Caucus. And that's Governor Raimondo and Nelly Gobea. You have the state office holders, two of them are women. You don't see them in that. Just this, I don't know what to make of this whole thing of the aggression in there, wearing the shirts and women can't vote and I just, their whole tone, for the life of me, I can't figure out why they feel, in a way, they're almost being discriminated against and they're just screaming out and women and I don't understand what their point is or why they feel they're being marginalized in any way.
Yeah, well, I think that's why this protest, it was unique because it was within the party itself. But it feels a lot like the other protests we've been seeing, the Wyatt Detention Center, the protest of the governor's presentation at a Boston Globe Roadmap event, the Yale-Harvard game yesterday. All these things, they have the same feel, and it's of people who've bought into this idea of radical protest and identity politics, and everything's an injustice, and nobody should have to wait for anything. There shouldn't be any. I mean, they're not necessarily against structure, but they don't think it ought to hold back what they believe is righteously right. And so that's the kind of the feel you get from this. And it plays right into the, so that's why I say the left is, and the Democrat Party is the party of the left these days. They've built up this expectation that if a man uses an animal name in a saying, I mean, I don't know what the saying actually is. I tried to research what it might be meant to mean. And keep in mind, the clip of him saying that is very short. So I haven't seen any context for what kind of back and forth there was before this or why he was saying anything at all or what he meant to say or what it was a response to. But the idea that that's instantly a show of chauvinism and then the news media picks that up and runs with it, and it's giving power to sort of it's a hard phrase to say, but sort of untamed radicals.
Yes.
They think this is the campus. They think you get away with this. They've been encouraged to do this their entire time in college, and then they get out and they're doing it in workplaces and in politics as well. And so they think this is how you get your way. And it's going to take some learning for them not to do it. But a lot of it's, you know, just a performance art kind of thing that the left has set itself up for, and they have no real way to respond to it.
You know what's interesting, and again, good afternoon, folks. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor, OceanStateCurrent.com. I think you're right. I just view them as that extreme group to the left, and I put them in that. That they just don't seem reasonable. They don't seem like people you can have a conversation with. To me, they're the opposite of what they preach. They try to preach inclusiveness. They try to preach diversity, when in reality, they don't want to hear anyone else's opinion. They're big on name calling. Oh my God, the name calling. Women marching in with t-shirts that say women on them. And just, we're all about women. We just have to promote women. Not the best candidate, not the person with the best ideas, just the women. It was former State Senator Steve Alves. He apparently, and they have him on tape saying, and I had never heard this before, but if a pig grunts, you don't grunt back. So then they're immediately calling him, well, he's a misogynist. And they're so quick on, if you disagree, you are, in fact, a racist, a misogynist. It's off the table. There's no discussion with them in any way. They can't imagine that there are Americans that would ever vote for President Trump. Like, in their mind, well, President Trump, he's a racist, he's blah, blah, blah. They even use the word. They were using the word white supremacy and a Nazi for that guy that ran against Maura Walsh. Like, it's incredible. These are supposed to be intelligent, well-educated individuals. But, boy, they resort to the name-calling. That's how they just label everything. But what do you make of the fact? So you have Steve Alves, a powerful lobbyist, and he's also on the State Democrat Committee. But, Justin, they at no point do they call for him to step down or resign in any way, which I find incredible, because there was that individual, Joe DiLorenzo, who they did rally against and go against. But my God, the element of victimhood here is really something to see.
Well, it's what they, you mentioned that they're educated, but I mean, that's, to some extent, they've been educated to do this. At this kind of activist strategy, and and with intersectionality, has become an entire world philosophy, or philosophy of the world. It brings things to that superficial level where if you use a phrase, then you're pegged as a racist and your content doesn't matter. And that's a lot of what this is. The content really doesn't matter. Oh, women aren't allowed to speak. I mean, they're talking about bylaws for a party. I mean, this isn't, you know, bringing in the state troopers with guns to beat on people or anything like that. I mean, this is the bylaws for the state party. It's a power play, but they've been trained to think, well, okay, he used a phrase with the word pig in it. That must mean he's sexist. And this is what you see in college, where if you're having a debate in a classroom and you use the wrong phrase, say something banal like black and white, like this issue isn't black and white. You're not thinking in terms of race, but if you say that in a college classroom, you lose the conversation because black and white, it's racist. That's the kind of level of conversation they're being educated toward. And it's just a way to gain power. And that's what was kind of fun in some respects. I mean, it was interesting to see it with Steve Alves. I remember years ago when he was still a senator, Monique Chartier on Anchor Rising actually did a quick, as well as she could, a review of how many relatives and close associates he had in government and insider positions.
Yep.
And so here we are some years later, and those insiders are now going up against this political creature that's wants power, wants things to happen now, and thinks that, you know, political theater is the end all be all. I think in some respects that's the lesson we get to after all these protests, is there isn't an effort to get to content, to get to a discussion about issues. It's about power and doing a performance in order to get power. And it's in the future going forward, it's all going to be about who can tiptoe around them. I mean, you see the governor. She's not part of the women's caucus.
She's not.
But she's trying to tiptoe around that because she understands that when you're in government, you have to be able to compromise a little bit when you have power.
Right.
Otherwise, you're gonna end up with big problems. And that's what's going to be very scary, is if we reach a point where there are no politicians able to tiptoe around these radicals and they actually get into power enough to start implementing their policies and shutting down any opposition to them. That's when things can get really scary real fast.
Yeah, and this is all within the Democrat Party. I'm just struck by the fact, a couple things. Number one, I like how Nancy Pelosi, when she summed up the squad, she said, well, they're four people with four votes, but they just live in this Twitter world where they think you just make all this noise and somehow you're having an effect. And President Obama recently kind of mocked that and said, oh, you think you're so woke and, boy, you're so justice and righteous and you think political activism is you tweet something out and put a hashtag with it, like you're not accomplishing anything. But one of the, quote, women's caucus, now think about this. She's a professor at Brown University. So she is at, I would think, one of the, you know, she's a professor at an Ivy League prestigious school. You're certainly doing well. I don't know this individual that well or at all, actually, of what her professional goals are. But when stands up there and says, you know, we hear about women's rights and women are marginalized and we're tired of being treated like second-class citizens and the da-da-da and this whole thing. And it's like, wait a minute. The governor is a woman. The Secretary of State is a woman. The person, Sid McKenna, has a position of authority within the party. You're a professor at Brown. I'm just at a loss, Justin Katz, as to where do they feel, where are they being victimized? Because it's lost to me where they're being victimized, other than I think they use the gender argument because they can't get their way in other ways. That's what I see no other. For instance, how is that woman not, you know, so is Governor Raimondo being treated as a second-class citizen? They trot out, although Maureen Moakley recently wrote a piece saying, oh, the reason she's not popular is because she's a woman. They just seem to really throw out the card, the gender card, a lot.
Well, that's the problem with identity politics is, as a strategy.
You're right, yes.
You can never win. Because if you win, they spent decades building up this giant weapon, and if they admit that they won, you know, as far as equality, then their weapon is useless. They have no more. They just have to put it aside and come up with something else and spend the next few decades trying to, you know, actually talk about issues maybe or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's where this weapon has nowhere to go. So you just now assert we are being marginalized.
Yes.
And
yeah.
You have to find reasons. And it just becomes a, you know, it's just a boomerang of the way the left has gotten in power.
Yes.
And it's always been clear this is why they wouldn't be able to govern if they ever did get power.
That's right. And especially just lastly, after the last debate, afterwards, Kamala Harris was like, how dare Mayor Pete say he struggled as a gay man? I mean, he's not comparing his struggle with my struggle. I'm a woman of color. I'm far more of a victim than he is. Just because he's gay doesn't mean I'm more of a victim than he's a victim. I mean, like, what are we talking about here? I want to move on to this headline. Rhode Island labor leaders stop tax funding of corporate health care. Big companies, Walmart, CVS, Bank of America included, should offer health insurance, low-wage earners. You know, whenever you see this individual, George Nee, time to close a loophole. Rhode Island allows corporations shift employee health care costs to the state budget. Whenever you see him at the podium, it's just so rich to me that he's lecturing on what corporations should do, because this is the ultimate. To me, his mentality basically is that of a communist and a socialist. But he says, George Nee, there's a loophole in Rhode Island health care system. Large corporations provide adequate coverage. They said they shift it to the state budget from their own balance sheet. He starts to go after the companies. Corporate welfare need to be stopped. I'd like your thoughts on that, Justin, because anytime to me someone like a knee starts preaching what corporations need to be doing, it's never good for those corporations.
Well, it's not good for anybody. And I think the communist reference is really on point, because here you have, you know, six-figure salary, super powerful man in the state talking, you know, taking a lead on communism on behalf of the working man. I mean, it's kind of laughable in a way. And I suspect a lot of this is theater, because they tried this last year and it was killed toward the end of the session. And I think they'll find they're not going to get even that far in coming up on an election year. But what really struck me about the whole thing is the attitude. If you listen to what they're saying, George Nee's big quote, you know, called out in the Providence Journal, was that these companies have a responsibility to provide health care. And if you stop a minute and step back from all the rhetoric and the talk and you know, progressive versus conservative, and think about what that means, it sort of put the brakes on. When I took a job, I didn't think I was picking my caretaker. I didn't think I was picking my father. You know, I didn't think I was picking the people who had a responsibility for my health. And that's really the attitude that the unions have. And it's for good, well, not good, for self-interested reasons, because if that's the way we think of things, you are the worker, they are the boss, they have a responsibility to you. We are the union, will come in and be your leverage against your master, basically, is how it works out. And so that works out well for the unions, because they get to represent the people against some boss who's supposed to owe them all this stuff. What it really ends up doing is it makes workers just replaceable, faceless people who aren't responsible for their own health care. So that's the philosophical point. But the economic point is, this is, you know, you're talking just a ridiculous policy. So a worker has a certain value given the amount that the company can profit off the work that he or she is doing. If you force the company to pay more, they're going to automate, they're going to reduce their workforce, and they're going to raise prices. And a lot of these companies, you say Walmart or whatever, a big part of their client base, their customer base, are the lower income working class people
right.
who will then have to pay more to live because somebody else is getting health care, getting through the government. I mean, it just becomes a big mess that kills the economy, but it helps the unions. It's just show of power, and so that's what they're going to do.
This business of the employer tax, when asked whether Governor Raimondo intends to reintroduce the proposed employer tax, her spokesman said it's on the table. And then, Justin, it is somewhat predictable. Nee starts to then rattle off, you know, the CEO of Walmart got $24 million, and the CVS Larry Merlo got $21 million, and Bank of America got $22 million. What a lot of people, and I don't think enough of this is explained, but when you look at, you know, Nee and the way the teachers union are run, the way the firefighters are run, the way the public sector unions, especially if you just stay with the teachers, a lot of these people don't seemingly understand is that the system that they describe and really work under, it's really a communist type of system, which is why it fails. The reason why, to me, the public schools fail is nothing there's no type of incentive. There's no form of incentive as far as for higher pay. All teachers make the same. And then if you're there longer, then you just get it. It's not based on ability. There's no incentive to be a great teacher because if you're a lousy fifth grade teacher, you make just as much as a great fifth grade teacher. They do it under the guise of the workers and fairness. But if you break down what people like Nee, what they're talking about, they're right in line with the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, which the principles are far more socialist communist. It's not based in capitalism, Justin Katz.
Oh, not at all. And I think this is one thing to watch in the next decade or two as labor becomes much more of a government thing and less in the private sector you see unions at all. Because it has been this increasing move to the left among the unions where they really do believe, you know, there's this sense that it's just this corporatism where the government and the big businesses and the unions all get to the table and they divide up the world among each other. And that's just how it is. And you're paid based on basically your number. You know, you're employee number 5532. So you're going to make a little bit more. And next year you'll get a little bit more. And that's just how it's going to be. And that doesn't create any real space for anybody to grow. I mean, that's what I find most insulting about all of this is it breaks us all up into these two groups, worker, management. Well, workers can become management and workers can start their own companies. And I mean, there's no incentive to do more because you'll get more money. But you know, at the low, you're not supposed to want to stay a Walmart clerk your entire life. I mean, if that works for you and it's a comfortable job and you're, you know, you enjoy the interactions, that's great. But it's not supposed to be something where you settle in. This is your job for the rest of your life. And if that means, you know, you have to go back to school or find a trade in order to get a job that pays for the better health care, then that's what you do. I mean, that's part of growth. It's part of what people have always understood in this country, and we're losing a little bit because it's just so politically advantageous for the labor unions and the radicals to keep pushing this notion that your boss owes you something.
Yep.
He or she is just out there making these millions of dollars, and if we pressure them, they'll give up those millions and give it to you. That's not how it works. If you want to take that money away, what you need is the free market attitude where more companies start up and other, you know, the employees can say, you know what, you're taking too much money out of the bottom line here. I'm going to go work for this person who will pay me more to do a better job because they're taking less money. If that's really how the problem in this system, that would fix it. And I think that's what we're kind of losing. And you mentioned Barack Obama earlier. Recently, I think it was Washington Post tried to pass him off as a conservative. That shows you how quickly we're radicalizing, at least the people who make noise in the public sector.
Right. No, he's definitely not a conservative, but I actually applaud him for speaking out, saying, you know, this Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren message of, you know, we need a revolution, and they don't want to improve the American system. They want to, you know, demolish it. They feel that they want to rebuild it. They do want, in fact, to have a socialist capitalist society, and they don't want to improve Obamacare. They want to get rid of it and just have government. I don't think people have any idea what it would be like if we had, in fact, a government-run healthcare. I mean, I know it's a topic for another day, but as I have my sister on once a week, and she talks about anyone that remotely thinks that's a good idea should try doing a any type of business or a transaction at the Registry of Motor Vehicles and see how that goes. And now picture that, you know, in a hospital setting, and look at the way the VA is a mess. I mean, anytime you get the government workers involved, it's a complete disaster. Folks, good afternoon. We're speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor at OceanStateCurrent.com. Justin, I want to move to another story, and I'm not surprised at this. To me, this is a lack of leadership of the mayor of Providence. It demonstrates the leadership within the city of Providence and the progressive movement, and that is vandals hit Christopher Columbus statue again. Well, they hit the statue and vandalized it with red paint on Columbus Day. Nothing was done. No camera was installed. There were elected leaders that said they supported that. I'm not surprised at this, but where they are so lacking any foresight is people like that Cat Kerwin or Mayor Alorza, where they say, oh, that's just, you know, harmless civil disobedience. They're so ignorant to the fact of who are they to decide what statues could be vandalized. There was a good piece that was then written in the Providence Journal that, and I think even the Journal then wrote an editorial about, okay, so I guess if you follow this train of thought, that it would be okay to vandalize the Vietnam Memorial because there are people that are against Vietnam, or the Holocaust Memorial, or the World War II Memorial. This is the leftist progressive mindset that they feel and have said it's okay to vandalize this because it happens to be the Christopher Columbus statue.
Right, well, not only it's okay to vandalize this, it's okay to be a vandal. It's that performance art radicalism that I think a lot of professors and politicians think is just people, you know, expressing themselves, you know, out there, and they're really not. The young folks are believing the radical message. What struck me, though, you're right that there was no talk of cameras. There's no talk of if we catch these people, we're going to prosecute them. Instead, what we got after Columbus Day was talk about, well, maybe we should move it into the Italian neighborhood so that they can watch their own statue. I mean, that was the talk we got. And so what that does is it encourages the cosplaying radicals to say, let's keep doing this. Eventually we'll get our way. I kind of wonder, according to news reports, this was spotted because a local Rhode Island podcaster, Bill Bartholomew, was walking by and took a picture of it. Makes you kind of wonder if this happens more often than we actually know.
Sure, you're right.
If they clean it up within 20 minutes to 30 minutes, it's entirely possible that if at 5 o'clock in the morning a police officer's driving by and says, oh, let me call in a DPW, they hit the statue again. I mean, this could be a weekly occurrence. But I think you're entirely correct. What needs to happen is, even if you agree with the sort of cultural message of that Christopher Columbus brought bad things to the Northern Hemisphere, to North America and all that, even if you agree with all that, I think as a matter of keeping a civic society where people aren't defacing each other's statues and ultimately resorting to violence, the message has to be, we will find these people and we will make sure that they learn the lesson that they're not supposed to be doing this anymore, that this is not how we conduct ourselves in a society. And until that's the message, I think we're just going to continually see an escalation. And in fact, it really is an encouragement to them. And I've contrasted this before. Of course, throwing paint on statues, not in the same ballpark as trying to recruit for white supremacist groups. But when a couple flyers were found within Providence,
that's right,
there were press releases with the police, the security chiefs and the police chiefs saying, we will not tolerate this in our city. I mean, that's a very different message to, they're expressing themselves.
That's right.
Maybe we'll move the statue. So some speech is okay, some speech is not. It all depends what you're saying, that treatment you'll get from the government. And that's not how you foster a diverse, pluralistic community.
No, and I blame the mayor on this. I do. And if anything, not even challenging and calling out members of the city council, because it's also selective outrage. You and I both know that if this was any type of vandalism on, if it was, just as an example, some type of statue, or if there was some organization that was either LGBTQ or Latino or of color, immediately Alorza would have some kind of a press conference, deem it a hate crime. This is not going to stand. This is one of those things, because it's a Christopher Columbus statue and because the left has this mantra about indigenous people, they feel it's okay and that they can decide this. And something another time to talk about is that situation at Bryant College where this student got up and started doing this comedy routine that, again, if you watch it, it is offensive. It wasn't funny. But there's something about the fact that they, some of the students just decided, like, this should not be allowed, and then took the microphone away from them. I think that's a dangerous road in some way. I mean, this is not one to defend. I don't want to come off, I'm not defending anyone that gets up and says any type of racist comedy routine that's not funny. But there's a danger that we're seeing on these college campuses between what Harvard, with Harvard, Yale marching in the field, the Harvard Crimson, that they're protesting and boycotting the Harvard Crimson because when they were doing an article about ICE protesters, they actually called ICE for a comment. And the protesters felt, what are you calling them for? You shouldn't even call to get their version of events. And then I think we had talked about the situation in Northwestern where you had former Attorney General Jeff Sessions come into town. A bunch of students were protesting. So the student newspaper there took pictures and posted online. There's protesters. And the protesters said, how dare you invade my privacy and post my picture online, even though they were publicly protesting. But I want to ask you, this was a story in the Providence Journal. Conservatives challenge Rhode Island campaign law. Two conservative advocacy groups are asking a federal judge strike down campaign finance laws, make them report political advertising and identity of their donors. Now, as much as on the one side, and I support the GASPY 100%, what is ludicrous is some of these people, the Bill Lynch crowd and some of these others try to say, oh, you know, dark money in Rhode Island politics and blah, blah, blah. This comes down to one of the reasons why people in our area are hesitant to donate is because there will be, as you heard, like the Brett Smiley, there will be political retribution if you support any of these organizations. So, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Right. Well, this is the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity has teamed up with the Liberty Justice Center, which is a national sort of an ACLU from the right in some respects, to challenge campaign finance laws in Rhode Island. And what it comes down to is, as you say, it's exactly that, is the idea of you can be targeted and intimidated for your speech. And where this is really over the line for me and for all of us is it's on ballot questions. So this isn't, you can kind of see campaign finance when you're talking about a politician, right? Because you can buy a politician, you can give them a lot of money to get elected, and then they'll make their decisions based on how much they were given, not the substance of a thing. You can't bribe a ballot question, right? Either it passes or it doesn't. And the voter has to decide whose information to believe and what information to bring to bear. So this is all about bringing out people's names, even forcing nonprofit organizations to put their donors' names on an advertisement itself. You know, let's make it really easy for all these radical protesters to find them and protest them. And, you know, we've discussed before, we've even seen indications where local radicals will go to the homes of even somewhat progressive Democrats in Rhode Island if they don't support a particular issue. So now you're going to start putting people who give money to an organization to inform the public about an issue to go after those people and shut them down. And there's no justification for it, which is why a lot of the precedent goes back to a Supreme Court ruling in 1958, which was protecting the NAACP's member list in Alabama, because they said you have no need for this except to find these people and make sure that they're not able to associate freely with people they agree with and support their causes. And so that's what it comes down to. And hopefully the federal courts will agree with a lot of their own precedent and say you can't compel people to identify themselves when they're supporting speech. And interestingly, in Rhode Island, I know because I've been the subject of some of these mailings, it's been found unconstitutional to try to prevent anonymous mailers in political mailers. So people can put out anonymous mailers, and there's nothing anybody can do about that. But here they're saying, but if you pay an organization and they go out and try to educate the community about, I don't know, bonds or whatever, legalizing marijuana or anything like that, then you have to – you need to be courageous enough to put your name on that advertisement and be known to the entire world in this radical environment where you've got people, you know, protesting prisons by stepping, blocking people from getting to work. And so to me, it's really a clear cut case, and hopefully it'll fly right through and adjust our laws to where they should have remained. I think this was in 2005 around then that these laws started to really come in Rhode Island, and really need to undo that.
You know, it's amazing also, Justin Katz, and it's a little bit different, but I was mentioning Ann Coulter, who's a guest on the program. She was scheduled to give a speech on the West Coast, UCAL Berkeley, and 2,000 protesters showed up. And not only did they show up to protest, but they were locking arms and blocking other students from entering that wanted to hear her speak. And so to me, these are the elite universities, Northwestern, the Harvard-Yale situation, Cal Berkeley, elite universities, supposed to be, you know, basically elite college students. And they're such hypocrites. If the roles were ever reversed, the way the media would treat that, but because they disagree with an Ann Coulter, you had protesters locking arms, human chain, and they wouldn't let people in that wanted to hear the message because they simply don't like Ann Coulter. And then, you know, the media, no one points out the fact how outrageous that is, how they're denying her freedom of speech, other people that want to hear it. The progressives that do this, and it is the Democrats and progressive left, how they would react, you know, if to put themselves back in time, if you ever saw a photo of a group of white students locking arms and blocking students from trying to enter into, let's just say, where Dr. King was going to give a speech. Or if in 2008 you had had a group of students locking arms to prevent people from going in to listen to a Barack Obama, Senator Obama at the time, candidate, give a speech. They would be up in arms. That's outrageous. This is wrong. We need change. They'd be out there in 2 seconds. They can't even see how pathetic hypocrites they are, where they preach diversity, they preach freedom, they preach inclusion. But boy, another example, and that's at a prestigious university. If you don't agree with them, not only do they disagree, they don't think you should be allowed in to hear the person speaking who they disagree with.
Yeah, my favorite recent example of this was a geological society that, you know, it's sort of a professional association for professional geologists. Their chief for diversity and inclusion led the way in blocking advertisements for Brigham Young University, because Brigham Young is Mormon in Utah, and they've got regulations on how they want their employees to conduct themselves. And it includes things you would expect from a relatively conservative religion. There's no bias to it. It's, you know, there's rules against, you know, cohabitation, that kind of thing. But because that also includes same-sex relationships, the diversity guy at the Geological Association blocked advertisements for professorships to his members in the name of inclusion and diversity. They said, in science, it's very important that we have diversity, because you need diverse views, which is why we're going to exclude these people, because we don't like their views. It's a bizarre, what's disturbing about it, it would be laughable, but what's disturbing about it is that these folks aren't laughed off the stage.
No.
You mentioned earlier the kid at Bryant. You know, I remember in college, you kind of say dumb things, and there's always going to be somebody who goes up there to try to get attention by saying something that's really outrageous. And what you do is you boo them off, or you kind of cold shoulder them, and
right,
they get their 2 minutes on stage, and then they go away.
Yes.
What we ought to have is these people who are saying, in the name of diversity, we have to exclude these people over here. They ought to be laughed, not forced out of their jobs, but laughed out of their jobs, because they're so fundamentally ridiculous.
Yes.
So the idea that we don't hear that is really disturbing. I think it's a function of the news media controlling the narrative. I think most people probably shake their head and go, that's ridiculous, and go on with their lives. But at some point, when all these people are graduating from these universities, having elite universities that are preparing the leaders of the future, as we started out by saying, they're going to get out into the real world, into working world, into political world, and they're not going to know that they were just playing. They're going to think what they were taught in college is the way the world is supposed to work.
That's right.
And that's when that starts going up, I mean, that's the cliche we've heard for the past few years is this is how you get more Trump. You know, when the people out in the real world who maybe weren't at college or weren't there when this radicalism was part of the menu, when they have to interact with these folks in the real world, that's when things can start to get dangerous. So it'd be nice if the real leaders of our society at the colleges and in the media and in the government could start realizing this and toning it down, because it's going to get bad once these radicals and more of them get out, the younger kids get out into the workforce and the government and start insisting on having things their way and throwing paint at a statue at that point is going to start to seem really tame. And one of the things about statues, they don't fight back, but other people sometimes do.
You know, that's an excellent point. And also, Justin, just a double standard. I've mentioned this before, but you have the head of the Providence Teachers Union, that Calabro, Mary Beth, she'll be on Twitter. And she'll call the President of the United States, you know, not only is he a liar, she calls him a war criminal, and he's a Nazi and a white supremacist, everything else. I mean, you're the head of the teachers union, and make no bones, no hesitation, repeatedly trolls him on Twitter, so everything else. The double standard, if Hillary had won the election, and if you ever had someone that was then posting those types of things, the outrage that would ensue. They would be immediately called to resign. But somehow it's deemed okay, right? In their world, that is deemed okay. Finally, I want to get your thought on, it's not every day that this happens, but you had a judge, this judge, Christine Jabor, and she's dealing with a victim who was assaulted by a Providence police officer. And so it's brought in and they say, oh, they've come to a decision, blah, blah, blah. So she accepts the plea. Then she starts to get information that the victim spent 3 days in the hospital, suffered from headaches. When you see the guy's basically, the police officer broke his face, knocked him over, broke the cheekbone in his face, out of work for 2 weeks. The judge starts saying, I never would have accepted this. I think, Justin, no, to me, this is unfortunately where politics, like a Pina Nerona, you know, the AG, police officers are not treated the same way in our system. They're not. This guy, this should have been a felony assault. It was a misdemeanor. But the AG's office, and I hear this from people in the past, the AG's office would say, hey, listen, we have to work with the cops. They're our backbone. We need them cooperating. We deal with them on a lot of cases, blah, blah, blah. And Nerona, you know, he wants to be, he's got a political career ahead of him, wants a future. He's a thousand times better than Kilmartin. But I just think it's another example where different classes of people, this situation, that individual, and I don't know all this whole story with this Victor Revere, I don't know him or what exactly happened, but there's no way this should have been a misdemeanor assault by this police officer. That was a felony assault. I mean, what he did to that guy. But the reason, and then the judges seem completely aghast of the whole thing. The reason it's accepted is because it's an insider, and that's just the way they worked it within the system.
But this is one where, I mean, I know my biases, so I always try to start assuming that I'm wrong on a particular case. But as you read the details of this one, I mean, there's a fight. It was the police officer's sister's boyfriend, now her fiance. And there's a fight. It took two months for anybody to even charge the police officer with anything. So now you're months down the road. The guy says he's on seizure medicine and he hasn't been working. And it seems like a pretty serious event. And the police officer's sister actually says he has always said, bragged about being untouchable. And so you put all of this together and it's almost like you almost wonder how off frequent this is. And just in this case, somehow the victim managed to get information to the judge. Normally, you know, the judge probably, they get used to just waving these things through. Okay, we got a plea deal. Here we go. Boom. Right off the table. But somehow information got before her, and she said, you know what, this is actually a travesty, but it's too late now. It really is unfortunate, because even if up to now it wasn't true that this police officer was untouchable, that is definitely going to be the impression people get going forward, and with good reason. If they're confident that they'll be able to, you know, get the easier plea deal and move on down, and then even if the judge finds out later on, the most she'll do is kind of say this is a travesty from the bench. It disrupts all of our trust in the system. And I think Rhode Islanders don't have a whole lot of trust left in the system to be encountering stories like this.
Folks, again, he is the managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. He's Justin Katz. Justin, great job, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, John. Look forward to it.
All right, folks. There it is. Justin Katz joining us on the John DePietro Show.